Welcome to Beer, Beats, and Business, the business podcast for smart people who appreciate the insights found in a good conversation. That guy sitting at the end of the proverbial bar is your host, David J.P. Fisher, but everyone around here just calls him D. Fish. He's an author, speaker, and business coach. Basically, he's a professional talker. So grab a glass of your favorite beverage, grab a seat, and join us for today's episode. Let's see where the conversation takes us.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to another interesting conversation with an interesting person. Today, the part of interesting person is being played by Scott Sambucci. Scott is the founder, the head honcho, the person who's running the show over at Sales Qualia, which I may or may not be saying correctly. But he is a startup coach, a speaker. He's a best-selling author. And really, he's focused on helping early stage B2B startups grow revenue and build repeatable sales processes. So I am excited for our conversation. Scott, how are you doing today?
Dude, I'm doing well. And you nailed it. Sales Qualia. You got it right. And you got my last name right, which most people don't get. So thanks for that.
Well, it's always good to get two gold stars right at the top of the podcast. Well, and I do want to say thank you to our sponsor. We've got a new sponsor for the next few episodes. Urban Renewal Brewery right here in the Chicago area on the north side. They're awesome guys. And today I am drinking their Kiss Kolsch. Kiss, of course, keep it simple, stupid. You can also fill in your other word that starts with S at the beginning if you want. So thank you to them. I'll be drinking this during my conversation with Scott. And here's a question to get us kicked off. We are recording this in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic. And I think that there's a lot of things that we're learning about ourselves, about our friends and neighbors, about our society in this crisis period. I want to talk about sales with you. What do you think people were getting wrong about sales that we're now finding out because of the new environment that we're trying to sell in?
So the biggest thing that I'm seeing right now, David, like that where things get magnified in this crucible is too often in sales, the entire system was drifting too much to product and pushing and blasting.
Okay.
And in this environment, what's become the imperative is whether or not you can solve a problem for your customers. And it sounds really basic. Like, of course, like as a salesperson, you should want to solve problems. Your product should solve a problem to help your customer get an outcome. But over the course of the last, you know, call it the last 10 years, where you have a global economy that's been ripping forward and up and up and up, when you have all of the sales tools that have been developed over the last 10 years, mm-hmm. from everything right. from marketing automation to sales automation to CRM to tracking to this and that, you've got a big tech stack, and you've got the specialization around the sales process from, you know, from marketing person to SDR to AE to sales engineer to implementation specialist or account manager, like all of that system has gotten created, and this rising tide of economic flow, it's easy to just like batch and blast, like, oh, we got this lead list, let's send out 1,000 emails and let's see who we can get onto a demo. Right. And like you just see it, you see over and over, like everybody listening that's on LinkedIn, how many times you get this crappy spammy email in your inbox for whatever insert service or product it is? How many times are you getting on a cold email list? You're like, why am I getting this email from this person? Like asking me if I want to book a demo. How did I get on their list in the first place? I don't even know what they do, and they want me to book a 45-minute demo with them. And oh, by the way, here's the Calendly link that they want me to go into their calendar and figure out a time that suits them instead of them like figuring out what time might even work for me. All of this is like batch and blast and push product and get on demos. And what, in my opinion, has gotten completely lost is like, how do we have a conversation with somebody to even see if they're interested in engaging with us? Do they even have the problem we think they might have? And if they do have that problem, maybe we could talk about how we could help them solve it or even define the problem before we help them solve it. Then we can talk about whether or not there's a sale.
Right.
And in this environment where all of the attention has been stripped away from anything that's extraneous or bloating or unnecessary, and people are just like, I got... Like you and I were just talking before we kicked off here, David, like I got 4 hours a day to get my work done because the other 4 hours my wife needs to work and I've got a kid at home and I'm trying to balance my health and keep everything else in order. Like I don't have time to do anything other than what's essential. And if somebody's not coming to me with a really clear value proposition around the problem they can help me solve, then I'm not taking that meeting. I'm not paying attention to that message.
Right.
And so in this environment, I feel like this has gotten so magnified now that the people that have, that don't have that clear value prop, that aren't out there genuinely curious and genuinely looking to solve problems, those people are getting slaughtered right now. And the people right. that are going to survive and thrive, and we're seeing this with our own clients. We have clients in the healthcare sector, manufacturing, construction, all selling software into these industries. And over the last 2 weeks in our Slack channel, I'm seeing these clients telling me, I just converted a $120,000 deal with a regional bank. I've closed my first two U.S. customers in the healthcare system. Somebody else closed a deal with GlaxoSmithKline in their manufacturing facilities. Like, these people are solving problems and therefore getting purchases. So if you're not solving problems, then you're not going to have a sale. And this pandemic, I think, has just magnified that to a 100th degree.
I think you're right. And I mean, I've been preaching the power of empathy and the power of relationship and conversation for years. What you're saying makes me feel good that I wasn't just sitting here beating my head against the wall for nothing. Because when you're competing against companies that just want better and better sales stack, you're like, wait, there's more to it than just, you know, the email funnel that you're putting people into. Tying into what you just said there, some people, there's two messages I think someone could get from your statement that you've got to come with value. Because I think what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is it's really about the empathetic conversation, the curiosity, the really diving in instead of going for scale and blasting people, really kind of understanding what you do, what they need, and how those two things fit. Because I could also see somebody going, oh, so the trick is just to make sure that I've got the ultimate value proposition. I just have to word it the right way and make sure my email has just the perfect copy. Then I'll be successful.
No, I think it's definitely the former. I mean, you could have the perfect email copy, but if you're not genuinely curious, if you're not like sincerely looking to solve problems, if you don't love your customer enough to say like, I want to help you with this problem if you have it, then it doesn't matter how good and how polished the email is, because that prospect is going to sniff you out in the first call. You could have the perfect email right. written, get them on the call. And if the first thing you do is like, hey, let me just show you the product.
Explain that to me a little
Sit
bit.
Back, explain you know, get your popcorn, 45 yeah. minutes later, 73
I'm
clicks later.
You. So you just said like, you have to love your customer enough.
Ready to talk to me about problems and be empathetic and help me find a solution. And now all they wanted to do is get me on a demo. So it needs to be genuine. You need to, you know, to your point, be empathetic to their situation, understand their problem and situation, understand that maybe they're interested in learning about your solution now, knowing they might not be able to make a purchase now, but it could definitely be a Q4 thing, but they have
right.
the ability, they need to look at it now because the cycle times have lengthened because not everybody's in the office and the buying process is different and the way they have to justify budget is different now than before. And like understanding all of those things might mean that you have to take that longer approach and understanding their situation and be empathetic, not just to their problem, but their decision-making. And so like all of that comes back to like really understanding what's going on with your customers, being willing to work with them to solve their problems in a way that's going to allow them to get the outcomes that they want.
So go back. You said you have to love your customer. What do you mean by that? Because I agree, but I think a lot of people, especially in the sales world, would kind of push back because it's such a hard charging, you know, kind of ego driven position. What do you mean by love?
That's a good question. And so when I say love, I mean, like I work with startups, right? I work with B2B tech companies, right? Most of the companies that we work are either seed stage or Series A companies. We work a lot with the CEOs and we work a lot with their early sales team, right? And the reason I started this company to work with those teams is because I've been that person at three different startups. I've been a CEO of my own startup in the past, and I've been the head of sales for three different tech startups. I was the first non-technical person at three different tech companies. I know what that's like, trying to get from your first 100K in revenue right. to the first million in revenue. And then when you get to the million and then you close the next round, then it's okay. And how do we get from one to three? It's like, I know what that's like and I appreciate what that's like. And I know how hard it is for people. And I've done sales and it was hard for me. And now I'm talking to a tech CEO who might have been an engineer. She might've been a project manager. She might've been a product person, but she's never done enterprise sales. Right. And now I've got to help her get from 100K to 1 million or from 1 million to 3. So even for somebody like me who's done sales their whole life, it was hard. So layer on top of that, then I didn't really understand what enterprise sales really is all about. It's even more difficult. So when I say love your customer, it's like understand their situation, like want to help them, like want to solve that problem. Because I know if they don't solve this problem, if they don't figure out how to get from 1 million to 3 million, they are not going to get the next round of funding. They're going to run out of cash in 12 months. They're not going to get the Series A or Series B that they were looking to get. They're not going to be able to hire the people that they want to hire to really scale the thing. And they're going to either end up in purgatory, just bubbling around at $2 million in revenue, or worse, eventually they're going to burn out or die out.
Right.
And so I look at that situation and I appreciate that situation. I want to help that person if they want the help. I can't help everyone. You know, a lot of people say, oh, you work with tech startups. A lot of people must need that. And I'm like, yeah, a lot of people need the help, but I can only people who want the help. So when people step into that conversation with me, it's like, I want this help. Then I'm like pulling them into my world and saying, great, I'm going to help you with this. And I treat those clients like when they have the wins that they post in Slack, like the first thing I'm doing is like fist pumping for that guy that just closed $120,000. Right. I'm like, that is awesome. Cause I know how hard he's been working for the last 6 months to develop that lead, do the demos, coach them through that, and finally get the contract signed. And I know that one deal is a catalyst to the next couple of deals because now he's got a case study or a logo that he can share. Like that means a lot to me. And when they don't get the deal, it hurts. And you should want to feel that with the people that you're helping on the other side. Because when you do that, then they know that you're out for their best interests.
Right. So it's almost like you need to, on some level, be invested in the success of your customer. I'm always leery of the word passion because I think it's really overused and doesn't have a lot of meaning, but you have to actually care, right? You can't just call it in, right? So what's really interesting as you're saying that to me, I'm thinking back to what you were saying about the last decade, seeing more of a process or technology driven sales style. And it almost seems like what had happened was the salesperson had just become another interchangeable cog in the machine. Right. Yeah. I mean, if you think about, you know, SDRs, for example, it's like, well, just give me some kid who's 24 and I don't care if they really know our industry, as long as I can follow a script, right? And
yeah,
that's kind of the exact opposite of what you're telling me, which is like you actually have to, even if you haven't been in the shoes of your prospects or customers, you have to be able to empathize and understand and then want to help them, right? It truly is kind of a caring or giving role. Is that right?
It is. I mean, the SDR role, I think, is a good one. And I don't want to single it out and pick on that role. It's an easy one to use as an example.
Yeah. It's been the whipping boy.
Yeah. Well, let me look at the job and the same on customer success on the other side. And I can explain both examples. So like the SDR, even in job postings for SDRs, I've seen job postings where it says, this is a 12 to 16 month position. And if you're successful, you'll get promoted to account executive. Like they're selling the job as being temporary. Like you're just going to, it's like a rite of passage to be an AE. And so if that's the person that's sitting in that seat, do they really care about the customer or do they care about like, what numbers do I have to hit? What metrics do I have to hit in order to be an AE so I can go make a lot of money? I'm just going to do this SDR job because it's like the next stepping stone to the AE position that I really want. Right. And it's the same on the customer success side. I've seen this. Like, I don't really want to do customer success. What I really want to do is product, but I don't have a product background. So if I go do customer success work, after a while, I'll really understand the customer and how they're using the product. And then I can get promoted to the product team, right? So, and I'm not saying that every SDR that takes that job or every customer success person feels that way, but it's made it the system that we've created has made it too easy to just drop people in and forget about who is the customer here? What do they really need? And when I'm doing that, when I'm sending that outreach, you know, if I'm sending that email or a LinkedIn connection or commenting on somebody's post, am I really commenting on the post because I like that person's post? Or am I just hitting like so that I have an excuse to go send them a DM on LinkedIn hoping that they'll see my email? Like, I know there's and I'm not trying to be Pollyanna and like, oh, it's all kumbaya and you should only care about helping people. Like, I understand there's a tactical side to this, but there also needs to be, you know, some soul to what you're doing every day. And like, and whether it's like love your customer or just like believe in your product. Like, I remember, and I've told this story to my clients the last couple of weeks in particular, because it's so important when you're selling in this environment, in any environment, but particularly in a volatile market. Like, you have to wake up every day believing that your thing is the thing that your customers have to have. You have to have that conviction. If you don't have that conviction, then it's going to come through when they tell you, I don't know, it looks really good, but I'm not sure if we're ready to take action yet. Or it sounds really good, but it seems really expensive. Because if you don't have that conviction that they should, if they don't have the budget, then they should go to the bank and steal the money or like talk to their CFO and beg for this budget, even if it means possibly losing some face with that CFO. Like, you have to walk into that conversation with that conviction. And my very first job, like my first real sales job out of college, I sold college textbooks for what used to be Prentice Hall, now it's Pearson Education.
Okay.
In my first 2 months on the job, I started the job in October, and my sales manager said, look, this year is already gone. Like, you can't earn a bonus this year because we do annual bonuses and it's too far gone for you to earn a bonus. So I don't want you to make any sales calls for the rest of this year. I want you to go to the university campuses and your accounts. I want you to figure out who's using our books right now. Like, only users of our textbooks, whether it's in, you know, the math department, the science, the chemistry department, you know, the business department, whatever department. Here's the list of people using our books, and go talk to those professors about why they're using our book. That's all I want you to do for the next 2.5 months. So every day on campus from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m, because he told me I had to be on campus every day from 8 to 5 for 5 days a week for 2.5 months. All I did was talk to people using our product. And almost every time, people are like, oh, I love this book. The way that this calculus textbook presents this chapter is really good. And I've looked, searched far and wide for a calculus book for 20 years. And finally, this author has finally written a book that I can use in my class to explain this really good, difficult topic. So now the customers are indoctrinating me. Like, every conversation is like, your books are awesome. Your product is great. I love the PowerPoint slides. I love the website that goes with the book, the CD-ROM that goes in the back of the book. My students love it. So when the calendar turned and it was January and I had to go out there and actually sell for the next year, I was indoctrinated. Like, I was convinced, I had belief that of the thousands of textbooks that we published, I had 5 catalogs that were hundreds of pages thick, because I sold everything from, you know, top level graduate chemistry textbooks all the way down to, you know, 2,000 students in a, you know, algebra course at a state school. We had thousands of books I could sell every day. I was convinced that any book, any class, any professor, we had the best book. I was just convinced of that.
I'm chuckling inside because I got my start selling cutlery, Cutco knives. And even though I was only 20, I knew we had the best. And to your point, I remember selling both in that role and other sales roles subsequent to that one, that I had made sales because somebody would look at me and go, should I do this? And I could 100% as a representative go, absolutely. No, you know, and they could tell in my voice that I had that confidence. And so I think you're exactly right. Having that belief is so critical. And I think we've, especially, you know, salespeople coming into the industry or whatever industry they're in, whatever their sales role is, we do a disservice where we just go, okay, you're starting on Monday. Here's your lead list. Here's Sales Navigator. Go.
Here's the template emails that we're sending out. Just change your name on the signature and go. Right?
I mean, it's tough because we do want to, I think organizationally, companies want to be efficient. They don't want to necessarily say, hey, we're going to pay, you know, you for 2.5 months to not sell.
Totally.
But here's maybe the but. Maybe we're realizing that's not necessarily the best way. You know, I think of the old Xerox model, right? Where there'd be a new sales rep and you'd basically shadow an experienced sales rep. I think it was for 2 years. Mm-hmm. But it was for a while. To the same point, they wanted their salespeople to be, I've seen it all. I know why our customers love us. I know what problems can crop up, so I can actually engage with our prospects and go, no, you don't want that one. You want this one. Or, you know, I don't know, how many copies are you making a day? Oh, that's going to break because it's too small. You need the deluxe version. But it really does come down to, as you said, kind of that human, you use the word soul, right? Again, words that are not used very often in sales books, soul, love. But there is something to that human element of actually caring about the person and wanting to see them be successful, because that's what people latch on to, right? I've been sold to. I've had SDRs and AEs call me, and usually unsuccessfully. And it's not always because their product is bad, but it's just like, wow, you know nothing about me or my business. And that comes through. So no, I don't want to buy, even though you're giving me a discount because it's the last day of your quarter and you're trying to hit a quota.
Well, and I mean, and part of this too is a matching problem in the labor market, right? I mean, again, you know, we had this big upswing. So look, if you're hiring salespeople, the market, let's face it, the market is pretty tight. It's hard to find good salespeople, whether it's SDR, AE, customer success, you know, marketing, whatever that function is, the good people are getting snapped up, right? They're not on the market.
Right, right.
And you know, there's this pressure to grow. Everyone else around us is growing. Competitors are growing. The industry's growing. We got to grow, grow, grow. So we're just going to get somebody. We're going to get them in the seat, and we're just going to like have them push the buttons and do the best we can. And hopefully they'll catch up. And instead, I guess what I'm suggesting is, like, part of the matching problem is making sure that even before that person starts, like, is there a good reason why they want to come work at your company? Do they apply because they saw that this is a 12-month gig and then they could get promoted to AE? Or did they have, you know, somebody in their family get affected by this problem? Like, I remember our VP of engineering at Blend. So Blend is a lending platform. So it's a Series D company at this point. So it's, you know, it's roughly $1 billion valuation company at this point. So it's, I mean, it's still startup, considered startup, but much more developed, but early stage, right? We hired our VP of engineering, and this guy was a successful, had his own startup that he had sold in the agritech industry. And he didn't know anything about the lending industry other than he had just bought a house. And he's like, the whole process sucked. I hated it. And I just like decided, I don't want anybody else to have to go through what I went through to get a mortgage. Like, he felt that pain. And that was our VP of engineering. And he stepped in. And like, he had an emotional attachment to wanting to solve this problem, not because, you know, we gave him a bunch of stock options and, you know, it was a good opportunity to like build his own engineering team. I'm sure those things are interesting. And of course they're, you know, help to, you know, attract the right people. But at the end, there's a lot of VPs of engineering you could hire. But this guy was the guy who's like dedicated to the problem. Right. Our first sales team, we called it a customer success team before we even called it a sales team. When I was hiring people, none of the people that I hired, the first seven hires, none of those people had even been salespeople. I hired somebody who was a consultant at PwC in the mortgage compliance area. I hired two guys that were trading mortgage-backed securities. One was trading securities for a division of Bain Capital, and another one was trading for a hedge fund. And both of them had seen the entire mortgage market and decided, like, this mortgage market is completely screwed up. They left jobs from the East Coast trading desk. Now, you can imagine what a top-notch trader makes. They moved to the West Coast.
Right, right.
And were making salaries in the 100K range. Like, because they wanted to come work at the company. And to me, that was way more important than their ability to like go in and give a slick demo. Like, that stuff can be taught.
Right. Well, you're really going to that idea of the kind of the tangible versus intangible skills to hire for, right? Instead of going, hey, and I actually see this a lot too when I look at sales role, you know, job descriptions or hiring descriptions. You know, we want to have, you know, 5 to 7 years of experience in this industry. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe that's a proxy for skill, as you said, kind of delivering a good demo, or, you know, maybe the right way of making a phone call or sending an email. But I think you're right. It's this idea of let's find people who actually want to be there.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can't train that. You know, I've been speaking to sales audiences for almost 20 years. I haven't figured out a way to make people want to be somewhere if they don't want to be there. Like if I could, that would be a great book, and I could, you know, be on Oprah and retire and live on an island. Because that's really hard to do, if not impossible. We all are going to have like our own autonomy. We're going to define our own purpose, right?
Yeah.
I think that's a good place for us to do one of my patented non sequitur topic changes, just because I'm not that smooth.
Let's do it.
A radio personality. And we could, I think, keep talking sales for a long time, and we don't have that much time. So when you're doing this work with your clients and you're diving in, maybe doing some deep work, what kind of music are you listening to these days? Anything that's been interesting for you?
Yeah, so I'm
I told you, true non sequitur. I don't believe.
No, it's cool. I tend to only listen to, unless I'm in the car and I'm just like driving down the road, which I'm not doing a lot of right now, because nobody is.
Right.
I like instrumental music. And so like I listen to, there's a Spanish guitar. I don't even know if it's a person or a musician called Rodrigo E. Gabriela. It's like Spanish guitar.
There's two of them. I've seen them in concert. Yep.
Oh, you have? Okay.
Yep.
Okay, cool.
It's their names, Rodrigo and then Gabriela.
I figured that's what the Y was, the E. Shows how deep my Spanish is. My wife introduced me to them. She's like, oh, you should check out this musician or whatever. And I started listening to it on Spotify. Another one I listened to is Tycho, T-Y-C-H-O. I like the piano guys.
Who's that? I've never heard of Tycho. Is that a group?
T-Y-C-H-O. I think it's a person or a group. Again, like I'm not a music dude. Like I don't really get too deep into this. If I like the music, I just listen to it and add it to Spotify. I first found out about Tycho. I was in a Lyft in San Francisco going from my hotel to the office. And this Lyft guy had this driver had this music. I'm like, this is really cool music. Who is this? He says, oh, it's called Tycho. It's like, cool. So I plugged into my Spotify and I've been listening to him ever since.
I love it.
Yeah. So two cellos is another one I like.
Oh, I've seen some of their YouTube videos. Some of their more like their pop covers. I think they did a Star Wars cover once.
Yeah, they do all kinds of cool covers. So like that's the kind of music I listen to, because usually my work day is like most of the middle of my day I'm spending, you know, on doing coaching calls, talking to potential clients, interviews like this, recording webinars, all that kind of stuff. So I'm doing a lot of talking during the day. So I bookend the day with more focused, like working, building content, you know, any operational stuff I have to do with the business, that kind of stuff. So in the morning or in the evening is when I'm not talking, I'm just doing. And so, having the music in my ears, the instrumental, I find helps me get into a better flow. And whereas like words with, or music with lyrics, I just find distracting. So, yeah, that's what I do. That's how I use
very cool.
For the most part. Yeah.
That was a good one for me too, to really realize. Cause I, you know, a big music guy, but as I've gotten older, the power of having music there, that the trick is, yeah, either instrumental or I found, is in another language that I can't understand. It helps the brain kind of stay engaged, but not distracted. Right.
Yeah. I think that's kind of for sure. Yeah. There's another guy, Ludovico Inuati. Do you know this person?
I do not.
Ludovico Inuati, another person that my wife recommended me to. So it's like classical piano kind of stuff, but more upbeat. Again, I'm not a music guy. I don't really know what the genre would be or whatever, but I've been listening to this, like, almost the same soundtrack for probably close to a decade. Like, I used to listen to this. Seriously, I'm not very expansive. I know what works. And I used to commute from Davis, California, down to Mountain View. And it's like a 3-hour train ride on the Amtrak Capital Corridor. So when I first moved to Davis, I was working at a startup down in Mountain View. And I'd go down there on like a Monday morning and stay a couple nights and come back home on Thursday. It's before I had kids. My wife was working on her PhD, so she didn't even notice I was missing. And so I had to go down there for a couple of days. And on the train, I used to just, you know, put headphones on to get rid of the distracting noise. And I used to listen to this music. And that's one of the places where I did a lot of writing, a lot of blogging. So even today, like, as I listen to that music in particular, it's like, as soon as I hear certain songs, I can remember being on the train. It's so interesting how my brain, like, thinks about where I was when I heard that song. I can even remember, like, I've written a couple books, and sometimes I'll be reading the manuscript and I can remember what music I was listening to at the time I was writing that particular page or chapter. Stephen King talks about this in his book On Writing. He listens to heavy metal music while he writes. And he talks about how he can remember what music was playing while he was writing his manuscript. And when I read that in his book, I'm like, yeah, that's me. I can do that.
It's really weird how the brain works. That's actually been a theme that's been coming up this season, a little bit last season on the podcast, where people have talked about how we actually had Anita Nielsen on, who talked about mixtapes and how, like, she found some mixtapes from herself in high school and just is, like, immediately transported to, you know, like, that time in her life. And it's weird how our brain kind of does that. It kind of goes, what is the soundtrack for what I'm doing right now at this particular moment? And I'm going to come back. Anytime you hear that music, you're going to be able to come back to this. But it only happens every once in a while, right? So I don't know what the instigating factor is there that says, nope, we're going to imprint this memory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's certain songs. If I hear certain songs, I'm like, oh, that, I remember exactly where I heard that song the first time. And like, there's a Def Leppard song, Pour Some Sugar on Me. And that came out when I was a freshman in high school. Yeah. And this is like when I was like, I didn't really understand that kind of music. I used to listen to like pop music on the radio because I was 13 or 14 or whatever. But then I remember being in a car driven by a teenager. It was like a group of friends I was like introduced to, and there was like 8 of us in this car that held 4 people, because that's what you do when you're 14 and a teenager.
Yep.
And I just remember like the driver like blasting this song for the first time, and everybody in the car knew the song except for me, and I was just like looking at these other people, and that song reminds me of that moment being in that car, in the backseat of that car when I was 14. So weird.
I'm laughing that that's a song you're referencing, because that also has that song for people of a certain age, i.e. ours, like that was, I think, number one on the MTV video music countdown when MTV still played music videos.
Oh, yeah.
The whole summer. And like,
I remember that.
That was the summer that like I watched it every day for whatever reason. And so, yeah, going right back to that very specific time where you're still performing like what you think is cool. And you're like, is this cool? I'm not. And then I became a hip hop head. So I went a different direction, but it's still a great song.
I'm still trying to figure out what's cool, man. I'm 46. I'll be 46 next month. I still don't know what's cool. Now I just don't care.
Yeah, it's just not me. I've just given up any pretense to being cool. And I was telling my wife the other day, in fact, that I made a mistake in trying to be cool, because I played in a band for a long time and I picked a ska band, and we just were never cool. But we had fun, but we weren't cool. So I just gave up a long time ago. And with that, you know, I think that's actually probably a good place for us to wrap up. We're gonna
wrap up on a Def Leppard song. We started off talking about The Soul of Selling, and we're gonna wrap up with a Def Leppard video, Def Leppard song. That's awesome. That's why I love podcasts.
Well, welcome to my podcast.
This is awesome.
We didn't get to beer. We can definitely talk. See, the thing is, if I ask you about IPAs, you're out in California. We're gonna talk. Yeah, if there's another 20 minutes right there. I guess here's my question: what's your favorite IPA you're drinking right now?
I'm not too picky. I mean, I like them pretty hoppy, but not too like bright. I like them more like a heavier flavor IPA.
Okay.
I do like double IPAs, but those just, I don't drink very much. So like one double IPA and I'm kind of like feeling pretty drunk. So there's a,
that's one double IPA is enough for just about everybody.
Yeah. There's, there's a couple of local breweries here in Davis that popped up over the last few years and they have their own craft brews that they make. And so I'll go in there and try some of theirs. And, so that's been nice. Fun just because there's one that's actually like less than a half a mile from our house. We walk down there, they let you bring food in, and kids actually. So, we'll just walk down on a Friday and have like a beer or two and just walk home.
What's the name of that one?
That place is called Super Al, and it's in Davis, California.
We'll make sure we put a link in the notes, get them a little love. Very cool. Very cool. Well, and with that, I think that is a good place to put a bow on this conversation. Okay. One thing I do ask my guests at the end of the show is, you know, what's one piece of advice that you'd give someone to help them have a better day today?
We've got this mantra that we talk about it with clients a lot because they always worry about, like, we had this yesterday with a client, like, okay, so I need to get this lead list. And then like, what do I do once I get the list and start building out the email campaigns? And then like, what happens when I get the lead? Like, what's the sales process from there? I'm like, whoa, let's stop. Like, let's get the list first. let's figure out who we're targeting. And so all the other stuff you're talking about is a later thing. And so one of our mantras is focus on now and worry about later. And so like in particular for me, especially the last couple of weeks, you know, the ebbs and flows of the day sometimes are ups and downs. The ebbs and flows of weeks are ups and downs. And so every morning I wake up, I do morning pages. I write down a couple pages of like, what's ahead of me? What am I thinking? What's today look like? And the one thing that's been centering for me, and that is that the advice I give to people is like, just focus on now. Like focus on like, what's the first couple of hours of your day look like? What's that checkpoint in the day where you're like, okay, right, cool, now I'm good till lunch. And then in the afternoon for me right now, like we're going to do this podcast. I've got two more calls and then I'm going to spend time with my son and exercise. Like that's my next now. And then after that, we're going to come inside. We're going to have dinner and we're going to watch Mythbusters tonight. That's my now. So if you just focus on now, and then worry about like, I got a bunch of work I'm not going to get to until 9 o'clock tonight. And maybe I decide at 9 o'clock, I'm too tired and I'll do it at 4:30 in the morning tomorrow. But all regardless, it's a later thing. I can't do that work
now. So worry about it. Yeah. Worry about it later.
So worry about it later. Focus on now and worry about later. And it makes like, it's been so centering for me, especially in this environment that we're in now. Like we talked, you and I were talking about before we got onto the recording, like the stamina that's required for me to spend 2 or 3 hours in a stretch with my son. I haven't had to do that ever.
Right.
Not as when he's an active 8-year-old kid, it was like half an hour after school or, you know, 45 minutes after dinner or take him to the playground. He plays with his friends while I watch. I'm not actually engaging with him. Now I have these like 2-hour blocks where I got to like figure out stuff to do around the house because he can't play with his friends and there's nothing else to do. And what I found is when I sit around and try to like check my phone while I'm doing stuff with him or start getting lost in like, oh, I got to send out this contract or I got to follow up with that client. I just lose the opportunity of like, I got 2 hours to hang out with my son. And sometimes it's hard and it's frustrating because he's 8 and he makes all these rules up and he gets mad at me for certain things and all that stuff.
Right.
But at the end of the day, like I got this time with him. So it's the now time. So I'm not perfect. And I definitely run inside and tell him I have to use the bathroom. When I go use the bathroom, I like check my email just in case. I do those things and I know I shouldn't. So I'm not perfect. But it does remind me sometimes I do take a second moment, like, do I really need to crack up my laptop or should I just like go back outside? And so just focus on now, worry about later. And I think that will make your day better.
Love it. What's a good way for people to follow up if they want to get in touch with you?
The single best place I always tell people to go is just our company website. So as you correctly pronounced earlier in the episode, it's Sales Qualia. So it's the word sales and then Qualia, Qualia, salesqualia.com. And the reason I point people there is because the best thing that I always recommend for people to do when you get to that homepage, there's a big button right in the middle of the homepage that says, grab a free copy of my book, Stop Hustling, Start Scaling. It's 100% free copy. It's not like free plus shipping. It's a full book and complete PDF copy of the book. You just click, enter an email address so we know where to send it, and you get an entire copy of the book.
Perfect. Perfect. Appreciate that. And also want to make sure I say thank you to our sponsor, Urban Rural Brewery. I've been enjoying, I mostly am done enjoying it now because it's empty. They're Kiss Kolsch, and thank you to them. They are our new sponsor for the next couple of episodes. And everyone, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Beer, Beats, and Business. I look forward to having you join us for the next one. And until then, stay safe. And during these trying times, try to stay sane. Bye.
Thanks for stopping by. You can find show notes and links in this episode at beerbeatsandbusiness.com. We all know the best way to find out about a new podcast is through our friends. So please help us out and share what we're doing through social media, or just tell someone. And if you could do us a favor and leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform, like iTunes or Stitcher, that would be great. Want to get in on the conversation? Send DFish a message on Twitter at DFishRockstar. And we'll save a spot for you at the bar for the next Beer, Beats, and Business.